From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. This morning, Anna von Merton shares the story of what can be discovered by paying attention to glass plate photographs and of how, in the early 1900s, astronomer Henrietta Leavitt laid the foundation for modern cosmology through the act of scientific observation and artistic creation. Then we talk with Louisa Whitaker Brooks, assistant professor of chemistry at the University of Utah, whose research focuses on the study and manufacture of ultra-thin electronics materials and nanoscale circuits. So stay with us. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
When we think of astronomical discoveries, we picture an astronomer peering through a telescope at the night sky, finding distant galaxies or detecting the subtle motions of stars. But these astronomers and their telescopes weren't the only way that our understanding of the universe expanded. Our next guest, Anna von Merton, shares the story of what can be discovered by paying attention to glass plate photographs and of how in the early 1900s, astronomer Henrietta Leavitt laid the foundation for modern cosmology through the act of scientific observation and artistic creation. And she does this in her new book, Attention is Discovery, The Life and Legacy of Astronomer Henrietta Leavitt. Anna, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Before we start talking about really, truly what Henrietta discovered, tell us a bit about who she was.
Yes. So she worked at Harvard College Observatory at the turn of the 20th century. And she came into the field of astronomy at a very important moment in time. So in your introduction, you're talking about in the 19th century, it was, yes, you looked through the eye of a telescope, you observed individual celestial objects. And that was how information was gathered. Leavitt, when she came to the Harvard College Observatory, she was hired because there was this new technology, dry plate photography, that allowed to capture images of stars on a glass plate. They would coat the glass with a light-sensitive emulsion, place it in a telescope, and there, accumulating starlight, they could suddenly do a survey of the stars. So she was a well-educated woman, but we can think that women's colleges were just starting to come into existence at this time. But the director of the observatory, Edward Pickering, was very progressive and hired this female labor source to analyze these glass plates. However, Pickering was also very practical that the women could be a cheaper labor source because there was this huge influx of data that came with this advent of dry plate photography. So Leavitt was hired to analyze what was held there on those glass plates.
What did Henrietta do? I mean, I know so much of this book talks about her processes, but was she truly the pioneer in creating a three-dimensional universe from these two-dimensional images?
Absolutely. So let's talk about the significance of her finding, and then we can go back into the complexity of how she came to that finding. But her discovery was a principle that allowed astronomers to measure large-scale astronomical distance for the very first time. So you have to think, in Leavitt's day, there was no sense of depth to the stars. If a star shone brighter in the sky, there was no way to know, well, was that object simply closer to us, or was it equally bright as a more dimmer star, but, you know, that dimmer star was farther away. So there was no structure, there was no sense of our cosmos. And with this tool to measure astronomical distance, it was quickly applied, and the size and shape of our Milky Way was revealed. And then famously, Edwin Hubble used the Leavitt law he found one of these stars that Leavitt had been investigating in the Andromeda Nebula, as it was called at the time, and measuring astronomical distance, he proved it was so far away, it had to be outside the bounds of our Milky Way. So suddenly galaxies existed beyond our own. And then Hubble went on with each examination of a spiral nebula, finding one of these stars that Leavitt was an expert in, measure that distance to that spiral nebula, and voila, it became a galaxy. So this real three-dimensional sense of space, as you say, was created from this glass surface. It's just astounding the way that her discovery revolutionized astronomy.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Anna von Merten. She shares the story of Henrietta Leavitt, who was an astronomer. It's all in her new book called Attention is Discovery, The Life and Legacy of Astronomer Henrietta Leavitt. Anna, I think it's so fascinating to find out about these women in history. And it's become, I don't know if you want to call it a trend or what it is, you know, from the Hidden Figures and now this story about Henrietta Leavitt. There are so many female historical figures who made such great advancements in science. And I'm wondering what your process was, because you kind of have this interesting background of art and science and textiles. What was your process of finding out who Henrietta was?
Yes, absolutely. It was through an investigation of the glass plates that she studied. So as an artist, as a visual artist, I'm interested in patterns and how patterns are meaningful. We sort of pull forward patterns to create meaning. And I think both artists and scientists do that so well. So here I was at the Harvard College Observatory looking at some of these glass plate photographs that are over 100 years old. And that was the very first time I heard Henrietta Leavitt's name. And it just stopped me in my tracks. It was like, wait, what? This woman made this discovery that allowed for us to measure astronomical distance, and I've never heard her name. And, you know, so often the story of modern cosmology begins with Edwin Hubble, begins with that definition of Andromeda is a galaxy, not a nebula. And if you just look behind that, again, it is very much a hidden figure story where there is Henrietta Leavitt making this discovery. And without that discovery, Edwin Hubble could not have made his own discovery. And so Henrietta Leavitt studied Cepheid variable stars. And if I can dive a little bit into how she came to her discovery, she was assigned just to try to assess the magnitude of stars, the brightness of stars, and how they registered on her glass plates. So here, starlight would, you know, again, react with that light-sensitive emulsion on a glass plate and form a little black speck. So her job was to literally measure these tiny black specks and try to assess their magnitude. And in that process, she noticed that some of those black specks just slightly wavered over time in their intensity. These were so-called variable stars. And so she started a real investigation of these variable stars about so little was known. And she became an expert in identifying these variable stars. She discovered 2,400 variable stars in her lifetime. And if you think only a few hundred variable stars were known at the beginning of her research, that is just extraordinary. So she studied these variable stars, these wavering lights, and charted their light curves over time. And her seminal discovery was that she realized that the intrinsic brightness of a variable star was directly related to how long it took to go through its pulsation period. And this principle, with a little calibration, allowed astronomers to simply observe a variable star, observe its light curve going bright and dim and then bright again, and simply based on those observations, they could calculate how bright it should be, and then if it wasn't that bright, calculate how much distance was causing that light to dim. So it's a so-called distance ladder to the stars that Leavitt, through this discovery, allowed for measurements to take place. And what a gift, right? Think about that. Instead of trying to do any fancy calibration, you could just notice a star, see its light curve, see how long it took to go from bright to dim and bright again, and you knew how far away it was. I mean, that's just, we'll talk about revolutionary.
Yeah, that's incredible. So it makes me wonder if Henrietta was more a brilliant astronomer, or was it this process that she created and discovered and innovated that allowed her to make these discoveries?
Right. Well, because this technology that she was using, dry plate photography, was so new, she literally had to invent methodologies to work with the technology, because there were very inconsistent results across telescopes, different exposure times. I mean, I could go on and on with how divergent the results on the glass plates were. So she really needed to devise techniques to make sure what she was seeing on the glass was the same relationship as what was in the sky. So that was one of her innovations. But what I notice about these type of hidden figure stories is that so often Leavitt is if she is credited, she's credited with being extremely patient and meticulous and sort of, oh yes, she gathered all this data and then Hubble like implemented it. And that just gets me going because guess what? Hubble had to be incredibly patient, incredibly meticulous. And Hubble was doing the same act she was. He was measuring circles of light on a glass plate. And I like to point out that he identified one Cepheid variable in the Andromeda Nebula slash galaxy. And it was because of Leavitt's 2400 discoveries of Cepheid variables that he could make his own epiphany. So if you really think of the metaphor, Leavitt built a mountain and then Hubble is standing at the top. Why does the one person standing at the top get credit for the entire mountain? So I could go on.
Well, Anna, one of the things that I love about the book is there's all of these photographs and images of her original work. And, you know, these glass plates where, from my perspective, it's a glass plate with a bunch of little black dots on it. And her note-taking and, you know, it's so easy for us in this modern day to go, oh, she just made a few calculations, but pulled out her computer. This was all done by hand. How long would it take for her to create, to fully formulate these light curves or do a full calculation to prove her theory?
Well, that's an excellent point, right? Because she is a part of a tribe of women called the Harvard Computers. She was a computer. That was literally her job description. And if we think about the function of a modern computer, it holds information, right, that we can access. Leavitt was the computer. So her astronomical logbooks had to hold the information. And she really had to hold in her mind an build an understanding piece by piece by piece. And so how her mind worked and how she was able to access that information just completely boggles my own mind. Because if you think about, okay, she's trying to find, she identifies a variable star, she's trying to establish its light curve. She's pulling plates that are from random points in time, taken by different telescopes, different exposure lengths. And so it's not like you can just say, oh yes, this wavering light, I see it goes up and down and up again. She has all these data points that she's trying to assemble over time and from that construct an understanding for just a single star. And then she had to do that and apply that to thousands upon thousands upon thousands of stars. So she was really swimming in this sea of data that was completely undefined. And it's all the more remarkable, therefore, that she could pull forward an understanding.
You talk about the sea of data and, you know, back to the name of the book, Attention is Discovery. Her ability to focus and her attention on exactly what she was looking at, I think it's a very much a lost art nowadays. Is there a way that we can take Henrietta Leavitt's methods and use them today?
Yes, exactly. Her skill, her probably greatest skill was the active attention. And when I was viewing some of these glass plates that she studied myself, they're sheathed in an envelope. And as the glass plate sort of was unveiled, I thought, oh, I'll have a similar kind of epiphany that Leavitt does. And all I thought when I saw those plates was like, how did she even navigate this world of these tiny black specks? I mean, and thousands across the surface of glass. So she really trained herself in noticing subtleties, sustaining that attention. And honestly, I think it is something that we have to remind ourselves to practice. So that is one of the reasons I made graphite drawings myself of the glass plate she studied, because I thought, okay, well, let's go into this world. Let's dive into this world and see how she oriented herself, see what I myself might discover. And it is simply a steering back. Like it is very much a meditation practice. If listeners are familiar sort of with that idea, right? When you have an area of focus and the mind starts to wander as it does every single breath, and you just steer it back. So it's a constant sort of steering back to center. And that's exactly what she did. And she practiced it and was an expert in it.
Oh, that's so interesting. I feel like I read somewhere that you sort of facilitated an art show with Henrietta's glass plates, or maybe curated it. And I'm just wondering what people see when they see these glass plates, like how do they respond just seeing like you described, like these glass plates with a lot of black dots on it? I mean, did you help interpret it?
Well, I did. It was for a particular drawing series that I made, honoring sort of Leavitt's skill and her legacy. I took a unique approach to one of the drawing series. And in that drawing series, I magnified a plate that had particular artifacts, right? So sort of a particular plate that's across all the plates she studied. As I said, this technology was nascent. So it was just riddled with errors and riddled with these so-called artifacts, right? The telescope's lens would actually warp the stars at the edges of the plate. So I made a drawing series that magnified these sections of the plate where those artifacts, those warped stars, were particularly pronounced. And I sort of slowly crafted with graphite each shape and its translucency. And at the edges, the stars were so distorted that it seemed like wings were attached. Like, it almost seems like these stars became these like winged birds that were about to take flight. And so my own attention to these unique shapes sort of was a way to pull forward how each star needed to hold its own specificity, that it had its own sort of information that we could sort of admire and glean from, and then star by star by star build a discovery. And so that partly just the labor of my own labor in making these artworks reflected Leavitt's labor in forming this discovery. And it's just a reminder that how do we get anywhere, right? We begin where we are. We take that first step. So star by star by star, something is formed.
Yes. And this kind of connects us into a conversation about your background. So you are, as I understand it, but I don't think I really do understand it, a quilter. In addition to a graphite artist.
Yes.
And, you know, going back to this whole question of focus, and something that we've all come away from so much as our lives get more and more enveloped in technology and our attention spans get shorter, your ability to focus, I mean, is this also kind of the draw of what you do with quilting and graphite drawing?
Absolutely. I felt like a kindred spirit in Leavitt, that so much of my work happens to be very labor intensive and very detail oriented. So I saw such a similar methodology behind our two practices. But another facet of my work is that I am a visual artist. I make drawings and I make hand-stitched quilts. And one of the reasons I do that is I think objects are, and art objects in particular, are a really interesting vehicle to hold an idea, that I think they can sort of, as I say, carry a story through time. And if you think about quilts, right, that's what they've done generation to generation. There's sort of a story that accompanies a quilt as it's passed through generations of a family. And if you think about how I myself first encountered Leavitt's story, it was through the glass plate. So it was through these objects being preserved through time that I came to learn her name. So part of my motivation in making art objects around her life and legacy is that is a sort of a container that can carry her story. And already, that the exhibition of artworks I made in response to her life were first shown at the Harvard Radcliffe Institute. Last year, it traveled to the Illinois State University as well as Oberlin College. So there's ways that this story can be told and approached from new directions.
Well, in reading the book, Henrietta Leavitt published in the Annals of Astronomical Observatory of Harvard College under her own name. And that was a big deal back then. How was she able to do that on her own without any sort of male counterpart putting his name onto her discoveries?
Yes, and I would like to give credit to Director Edward Pickering of the Harvard College Observatory, because yes, he did hire women because they were a cheaper labor force to analyze these glass plates. But he truly, I believe, was an advocate and a supporter of women entering this field of astronomy. And the glass plates themselves, the collection was housed in what is called the Brick Building. And it was this fireproof institution, building that housed the collection. And in Leavitt's time, only women worked in that building, which I think is such a nice sort of extension of this idea of a room of one's own. When you have a place that is yours, your work is your own, and you can take it in your own direction. So Pickering gave Leavitt and her female colleagues, the Harvard computers, true agency in their own line of research. So he would say for Leavitt, yes, here you are assigned magnitude work assessing the brightness of stars, but within that, right, she could dive into this study of variable stars, and through that agency, through that and through her skill, came to this groundbreaking discovery.
Yeah, it was amazing to read about him because Harvard wouldn't fund the brick building or the Harvard computers, and he was instrumental in finding funding for these women to keep working. So much of the book focuses on her discoveries of the depth and the distance of stars. What else did Henrietta Leavitt do during her scientific career?
Well, that was a really interesting facet to research in the book, because she is known for this groundbreaking discovery, as she rightly is, but she announced that discovery in 1912, and she lived until 1921. So she announced that discovery in 1912, but she lived until 1921. And in that span of time, she was redirected back to standardizing photographic magnitudes. And at first I thought, well, this is just outrageous. This brilliant mind is relegated to this like very boring work. But I was like, okay, let's do the book. Let's do the research and see what's there. And what I discovered is that Director Pickering and Leavitt both were such ardent supporters of how to move the field of astronomy forward. How do we form a deeper understanding? And because this new technology, this dry plate photography, was so erratic, it really needed to be wrangled into a standardization. So, right, no international astronomical research could progress without sort of the information on the plates being calibrated to what's shown in the sky. And so that was even more intricate work, is what I discovered, than her variable star research. And she, I sort of like would be too confusing if I go down the rabbit hole of the weird and wacky photographic techniques she used to wrangle sort of bright stars and dim stars into conversation with one another. Because by the time, let's say you had a 4-hour exposure to pull a dim star into view, by that time, the bright stars on your plate would be overexposed and unreadable. So she had to figure out how to bring multiple plates, different exposures, different telescopes into conversation with one another and align their results. And what I found is that was truly inventive and creative work that was equally significant to her groundbreaking discovery.
Wow. I'm wondering, Anna, if Henrietta Leavitt and her photographic work, I mean, no doubt amateur and professional photographers, if they're listening to this right now, are sort of identifying with it in some way, but how did her work inform current day photography, if it did?
Well, that was a really fun chapter of the book to develop. So I wanted to, look at how her discovery remains relevant today. And so cosmologist Wendy Friedman agreed to be interviewed and sort of co-author through our conversations a chapter on how Leavitt's discovery is relevant to contemporary cosmology. And these Cepheid variables that Leavitt studied are bright, bright beacons in the sky. So some that, might tens of thousands of times brighter than our sun. So these stars can be seen very, very far away. And so Wendy Friedman, first on the Hubble Space Telescope, but now on the James Webb Space Telescope, is still observing these Cepheids, is still applying Leavitt's law to those observed Cepheids. And that is helping her establish distance markers right out in space and making as precise as possible the calculation for the expansion rate of our universe. So Leavitt's discovery is helping us specify this expansion rate, which tells us the age and size and scale of our universe. So, it couldn't be more relevant, more central to a contemporary practice today.
Yeah. Well, just quickly, before we let you go, she worked with Hubble or Hubble's work at the same time, resulted in a space telescope, a very famous one being named after him. But will Henrietta Leavitt, of course, now she has this book named for her, but has she ever been recognized in history, or do you think she will be in some significant way?
There is recognition of her, that her name will surface in various areas. She has a crater on the moon named after her. But, part of my goal, my aspiration with this book is to help really broadcast her story, because it is not hyperbole to say that her discovery founded modern cosmology. So it isn't just a recognition or sort of a pat on the back that I'm looking for here. It's like, let's tell the history of science as it should be told. And it really begins with her discovery.
Well, our guest today has been Anna von Merton. She wrote the beautiful book, Attention is Discovery, The Life and Legacy of Astronomer Henrietta Leavitt. And I wonder what Henrietta would think of the new images coming in from the James Webb Space Telescope. Quite a change from those tiny little black dots on a glass image.
Absolutely.
Anna, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, it's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Our modern society faces many challenges, two of which being alternative energy sources and low-cost electronics for daily use. Solutions for these issues and many others can be found in materials used in the products we create. Louisa Whitaker Brooks, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at the University of Utah, is on the leading edge of these technologies and developments. Louisa's research group at the U focuses on the study and manufacture of ultra-thin electronics materials and nanoscale circuits, while she continues to mentor women and minorities to choose careers in STEM disciplines. In fact, Louisa was awarded the L'Oreal UNESCO for Women in Science Award, among many others. Louisa, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Before we talk about your research, tell us about your fascinating background. What brought you from Panama to the University of Utah and the Whitaker Lab?
Yeah, so I'm, as you mentioned, I'm originally from Panama. I came to the U.S. back in 2007 as part of a Fulbright scholarship, where the top six students in Panama were awarded the scholarship to go pursue a PhD in the United States. It seems that they wanted to freeze me up because the place where they sent me was the University of Buffalo in New York. So as a Panamanian, that was that was a big change. So I completed my PhD at the University of Buffalo after 3 years. Then I went on to do a postdoc fellowship at Princeton University in chemical engineering. And then at that point, then you are at the intersection of, okay, so I start a research group or I go to industry, right? And after interviewing in both ends, industry and academia, then I decided to go to academia, mostly because in academia, you need a brain that is a little bit broader than what you will have in industry. In industry, you are set for a goal, and my brain does not work with a set goal. So I ended up at the University of Utah. And then another thing about academia is that you need to branch out so you don't look like your mentors. So the thing is that there, then you have to come up with very distinct research ideas that are very different from what your training is, right? So kind of like you have to like relearn how to do a lot of things in science. Then I took that as an opportunity to pursue things that I was very excited about. And one of those was climate change. And then understanding how we can use the materials that we are developing in climate change to also address low-cost electronics.
Well, one of the materials that you worked on as your PhD, and I thought this was so fascinating, was vanadium oxide. Tell our listeners about that and what you were able to do with that discovery.
Yeah, so vanadium oxide, as we will put it as a chemical compound, VO2, is very interesting because it's what we will consider a smart material under temperature or an electric field. So what do I mean by that? So if you actually change the temperature or change an electric field, let's say on and off, then you will trigger something that is called a metal insulator phase transition in vanadium oxide. And that metal insulator, as the name will say, will turn from a metal to an insulator or vice versa, depending on the temperature. The nice thing about that metal to insulator phase transition is that it also comes with a color change. So if the temperature is too high, then the material will just block sunlight. Then if the temperature is too cold, then it will make sunlight go through. So you basically can think about that as an intelligent window coating, right? So basically you don't have to destroy all the buildings. You just paint all these buildings with vanadium oxide. And then in that way, you can control the amount of light and translate it to heat that is going through the building. So that actually becomes an energy saver in terms of an electric bill. So due to that technology, as part of my grant work, then we patent that. So we actually have two patents related to this technology. And there is a company that was funded to commercialize these technologies in New York. So it's called Demian Inc. And then they are actually looking into getting the funds in order to have vanadium oxide in a lot of buildings around the U.S.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Louisa Whitaker Brooks. She is an assistant professor of chemistry at the University of Utah. And Louisa, I'm wondering, I mean, going back to Panama, it makes me think that maybe you were developing this product. It's hot in Panama. And, you know, energy in Central American countries, at least in my experience, is extremely expensive. And so I'm wondering, you know, ultimately, were you thinking you were developing something to help your fellow countrymen, or was this an interest that was developed later?
It was developed later. So actually, as a full disclosure, when I accepted my fellowship back in 2007, I was supposed to come to the U.S. to get trained on how to do water management, because, I mean, with the Panama Canal, the country is more interested in, you know, how do you think about water and preserving water, or even making cleaning water from the ships. So something that is important to note is that whenever a ship passes through the Panama Canal, they use fresh water. So it's not ocean water, it's not any other water, but rainwater. And the thing now is that you have the competition between the water that people drink and the water that you need in order for the Panama Canal to function. So whenever a ship passes, you use that water, and then all that water is thrown through the ocean. So the idea of me coming to the U.S. was actually to think about technologies that will help us clean ocean water. And that is actually called a desalination process. And as far as my PhD work, we actually do a little bit of that. Now, as an independent professor, we came back to doing desalination in a larger scale, and we are actually collaborating with a group at New York University in order to synthesize materials that will help us desalinate water at a larger scale. Because then in that way, instead of going through the Panama Canal, then you can actually have like a pump that will take that salty water, remove the salt, and then turn it into fresh water, and then put it back into the chambers of the Panama Canal. So it's kind of like a really nice collaboration. It all came to a closed loop 20 years later, basically, where we actually have a nice collaboration between entities in Panama and at the Panama Canal that are doing research and the University of Utah.
Wow, that's really cutting edge, isn't it?
Something that I was not expected to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a little bit of a tangent, but since you're still involved in the work, I find that really interesting. I mean, I've read articles about how the Panama Canal, you know, people say, well, wait, it's a canal between two oceans. So how can it be that there's less water in it, that they don't realize that there's less fresh water flowing into it? So this desalinization effort is so important, because I've heard, and maybe you can clarify on this, the amount of time that ships are waiting to get through the canal, it's almost more efficient to go all the way down around the tip of South America. Is that right?
With climate change, definitely. I was in Panama back in the summer, and actually discussing a lot of these desalination technologies that we have here. And one of the things that they mention is that the number of ships that are passing through the Panama Canal per day has been reduced because of water issues. So back in the days, on average, you will get about 40 to 45 ships passing daily through the Panama Canal. Now you're at 32. So the thing is that is actually a big economical impact too, because now you have a backlog of ships waiting to pass through the Panama Canal as well. So if there is more water, then that load of ships can actually increase to 45, but it used to be back in the days. But then it's more like decoupling two processes, because with the desalination, even though that it could be drinkable water, you don't want to risk it in terms of like the population itself or the people, but then actually use the water from the artificial lake that is the part that is driving all the water in the Panama Canal, which is it's called the Gatun Lake, because that lake also serves the population. So that is the water that people in Panama drink. So basically you have a competition between making money and keeping people alive. So what kind of balance you can have there? And science is actually a really good way to understand these processes and make technologies better.
Luisa, you definitely obviously have a brain that understands the big picture. You're looking at the big picture of the Panama Canal and the water issues. And you've transferred this into the Whitaker Lab, where you study nanostructured thin film fabrication. How do you find those two things correlate and enhance each other? Again, the big picture view, a very different topic to the nano.
Yeah, so the thing here is, I'm a material chemist, and I'm at the intersection of physical chemistry. So basically, we make materials, but then we also want to understand processes. And depending on the size of materials, then you get different properties, and that translates to different applications. So there's nothing wrong with bulk systems. I mean, just to put a size to it, a car can be a bulk system, but within that car, you will have very small pieces that are in what we call the nanoscale. So 1,000 times smaller than the size of your hair. So the thing is, and not necessarily every part of the car needs to be nano, but there might be a functionality in that car that would be enhanced if you have a nanoscale material. So we actually, even though that with nano, we can think about more revolutionary technological applications, because then you can talk about smaller electronics, smaller phones, smaller batteries, things like that. But do you really want a small battery for a plane? Do you want a small battery for a car that you're using to drive from here to California? But then understanding the application makes you tune or tailor materials according to what specific application you're looking for.
Well, I was reading about you on your Wikipedia page, and it says that you really became interested in hydroelectric dams when you were younger. How did you go from hydroelectric dams to chemistry and materials chemistry?
Going back to the fact that, you know, Panama is a very small country, and the way that we get power is by hydroelectrics. So basically, water is like at the center of everything. My family, my parents and my brother, they work at the Panama Canal. But at the same time, I have friends that don't really have a direct impact on the Panama Canal. But for them, their impact is actually on the side that you want to drink water. So the thing is that how do we, and in a hydroelectric, then you also have the fact that you are producing electricity from water, from that movement. So if the water levels are low, then you don't have any power. The thing is that now with a hydroelectric, and the same thing that happens with thermoelectric, so we actually use heat and water to produce electricity. The problem with thermoelectrics is that it doesn't give you a lot of energy. It's very cheap, but it doesn't give you enough energy to, let's say, power an entire country. So then you go to water, so the hydro part of it, hydroelectric, to produce electricity. But then now, if there's no water, then that is low. So what will happen is that a lot of time, you will lose power for days. And that was very frustrating for me, because I was into gaming. So imagine me playing my game, and then eventually the power is gone, and then you have to wait like 2 days to finish your game. So that, I don't know, as a personal way, I was driven into that. I'm like, what can I do with my skills in order to avoid people losing electricity and thinking about clean energy electricity? And so when I came to the U.S. and I went to the University of Buffalo, that stayed in the back of my brain. And I was like, all right, so can I actually think about technologies that will provide cleaner sources of electricity? Then When I finished in Buffalo, I transitioned into solar energy. And then we also, when I came to Utah, then we started looking into thermoelectric material. And not so much for like a large source of electricity, but mostly for like wearable electronics. Can I actually put a material on my clothes that will actually help me take that heat that my body is releasing and turning it into electricity? If I'm outside jogging and the sun is hitting my clothes, can that sun actually power some sort of like device that is in my clothes in order to generate electricity? And the problem with that approach is that you don't have a way to store it. So basically, if you run and you're producing electricity, you have to use it right away. So then that goes the other part of my program where we actually develop batteries. Because even though that you have a lot of electricity that you can produce, you need a place where to store it. So we basically have two sections of my lab that run in parallel. One that we call energy conversion. So that's basically converting either heat, water, mechanical energy into electricity. And then the other part that we call energy storage, where we take that energy that we have converted and store it in a device that you can basically use the power whenever, or the energy whenever you are ready to use it.
Well, and you talk about the Whitaker Lab, which is the lab that you run, and it's not just chemistry. Tell us about the other departments and how multidisciplinary this program is.
Yeah, so that was actually a big driver for me to come to the University of Utah. At the U, we basically foster an environment of collaborative research. So I have a lot of collaborators in engineering, because we actually make a lot of devices. So we have a lot of collaborators in engineering. We think about climate policy. So there is a lot of professors in the law school that are being involved in these different ideas. We think about technology transfer and licensing. So the University of Utah has a very great technology office that will support professors whenever they come up with different patent technologies and things like that. So for me, it was very important to have that complete environment, that even though that we work on very fundamental issues that relate to society, between commercialization and materials development, there is a big ocean in between. And there is a lot of different things that have to happen in order for you to see something commercialized or being in a real-time application. So we make a material, yes, but then we have to think about scalability. If this material can be produced in large scales, what is the lifetime of these different materials that are being developed? How do we think about packaging? How do we think about assembling these materials and devices with other existing technologies? And it's not like I do all that research. So in order for me to see my material in your commercial or daily use electronics, I need to talk to a lot of different peoples.
That's one thing that we've really noticed about the University of Utah. One of its greatest strengths that I don't think a lot of people know is how much of an effort there is to bring products that have been developed at the University of Utah into the commercial realm. Louisa, I want to ask you, you talked about having, you know, this wearable technology that can also create energy, but that we don't have any way to store it. It seems to me that there's a lot of innovation going on. We have these electric cars that drive so well and they have such torque and such incredible power, but we're really behind on battery technology. It's clunky. The human cost of it is huge with mining the rare earth minerals. And I'm just wondering, you know, at this point, we can't really store energy in our homes that is made from the sun, from our solar panels. Where are we? And, you know, what are the biggest impediments to great battery technology and storage?
Yeah, so you mentioned a very important point here, right? Because, I mean, right now, if we think about solar energy in the U.S., is not the main driver of producing electricity. So the thing is that if you have a solar panel in your house and you are consuming less than what your solar panel is producing, what you do is that you sell it back to the grid. And then the grid will just relocate that to a house that requires or a company or building that requires the use of that solar energy that you just generated. But if we translate what is going to happen in the future, we can think of every house having their own solar panel. And in that way, you will basically have way more energy than the grid can sustain. So basically, it would just be dumped or it would just be trashed. So the thing is, how do we actually come up with better battery technology that can charge faster? And at the same time, you can use it faster or store more. So can I store more and then charge faster? The thing is, in science, I wish everything would be moving in the same direction, but it doesn't. So when it comes to like materials development, if you want materials to store more energy faster, that normally strain materials because you are storing in electricity in between layers of materials. So the faster that you go in and out of storing, let's say, smaller ions like lithium, and we can talk about lithium for like 20 hours. But the thing is that whenever you are storing ions in there in order to store electricity, as a number of cycles go, you are degrading the material. And not just that you're degrading the material, if you're trying to charge it faster or use it faster, then you generate an increase in the voltage resistance of that material that will end up it would just caught fire, right? And that's why you see that there are so many issues with lithium batteries around the globe. And not just that, but then you have lithium that is very well, I don't know if it's just by luck, but all the lithium mines are actually in not very good strategic points for the U.S. And there's a couple of lithium mines here in Utah, but not at the point where you can sustain lithium ion batteries for the entire country. So then the idea is, how do we actually come up with better battery technologies? Like in my case, we are actually looking at materials to move away from lithium and then go into sodium ion batteries. The thing with sodium is that it's a little bit larger than lithium, so it means that it moves slower. So then it means that you cannot charge and discharge a material as quick as you would do with lithium. But if you're patient enough, it will get there. But the thing is that humans are not patient enough. We want our phone to charge in 5 minutes instead of three, instead of 10 minutes. So the thing is, and we also look into multivalent batteries. So basically, instead of charging one, instead of storing one charge, we are looking into multivalent ions. So it means that instead of charging one ion, we are charging 3 to 4 charges per battery. So that increases the capacity of the battery.
Well, Louisa, before we let you go, you are very, very involved in mentoring women and minorities in developing and coming into STEM careers. Why is it so important that we include all of, you know, different people of different color and different genders in these fields?
Yeah, so something that I learned, and I always stayed in my back of my head, when I received that L'Oreal fellowship, that we actually started talking about women in science, and they actually gave the example of the car seat. So the first car seat that was developed back in the days was actually developed by somebody that had no kids, ironically. But the thing is that when they actually started putting this in the car, then they realized that there was a lot of, the idea was good, but the design was completely off. And then they were like, well, how about if we ask somebody that has a kid? So that is the same thing that I see here in science. So if you actually have, and we all have our ways of thinking, and it's not really related to race or gender or anything like that, just that we have different ways of thinking. And if we actually do not include people in the different aspects of generating a technology, then we will miss an angle that we are just not seeing. And that is the importance of bringing all people together in order to see different ways of tackling the same problem.
And you are the perfect example of what all those different thought patterns and waves of perceiving the world can create very important things for the rest of us. Well, our guest today has been Louisa Whitaker Brooks. She is an assistant professor of chemistry at the University of Utah and the founder of the Whitaker Lab at the U of U as well. Louisa, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's such a fascinating conversation, and it's great to hear what you and your lab are working on.
You're welcome.
You're listening to KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County and 91.9 FM in Wasatch County. Stream us live on kpcw.org and ask your KPCW app or smart speaker to play KPCW. And you can find all of our shows under the Shows tab on kpcw.org.